everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with myself, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Kane Glancy.
Hello, Jasmine. Hello.
It's nice to have you on. It's a change of scenery.
It is indeed, yeah.
Obviously, you've held the fort in my absence in the past couple of weeks, so that is appreciated. I've heard you
I've done my
job.
Best. It's the big shoes to fill. Yeah, big shoes to fill, I.
Stop it. No, oh God, that made me cringe. Me, not you. So anyway, this session was on DPIAs. A great turnout again now that you can gain your IAPP credits for it. If you haven't heard so far, we're very excited about that. And we're trying to spread the word as much as possible. But yeah, so it was a great session. Took a couple of minutes to get into it for myself because I've had a little time away and my brain's still in Berlin, I think. But but it was great. And honestly, you did great. Thank you for joining me, Kane.
That's not a problem. It was a great session. It was a lot of fun. I love DPIAs. It's a big passion of mine. So it's really interesting to talk about that with obviously everyone else that was on the session. Again, super interactive session. It was really interesting hearing your guys' thoughts and your approaches, you know, particularly talking about the aftermath of the DPIA. You know, we know that this isn't just the end of the goal, you know, it's only just the beginning, and what we actually do to really combat that is super important, and looking at culture of an organization as a whole. And I thought it was a really good session. So I hope everyone listening enjoyed it.
Yeah, definitely. I think it was very relatable for people. I think yeah. Sometimes, you know, talking with data protection, fellow data protection practitioners can feel more like a therapy session.
Sometimes, yeah, sometimes.
Because it can be a lonely role when it's internal. So just knowing, you know, that you're not alone, I think can help at times. But, you know, at the same time as well, DPIAs alone can be very complex things because they encompass mm-hmm. all areas of data protection that you need to consider to identify risks. But also just the simple completing a DPIA and you know, the what surrounds that in terms of being notified as a data protection officer of when, you know, there's a new project, or how extensive you go into the risks and how you identify risks. It can be very tricky, so and subjective at times. So there was a lot to unpick, and it can be hard to, you know, stay on track at times while covering all bases. But I think we definitely covered all bases within
that.
We did. Yeah. Yeah, but we hope you enjoyed the session anyway. We'll let you get stuck in. And if you are interested, we do have DPIA training occurring on the 18th of September. It's a morning session for 3 hours. So do let us know if you're interested on info@dataprotectionpeople.com, and we'll send over some details. But in the meantime, enjoy the show. Like to let you all know that the session is recorded. There's a privacy notice on screen, and if there's any problems with that, then please let us know after the session and we will see what we can do. So how are you both doing? What have you been on with this week?
I'm not bad, Jasmine. I'm not bad. It's been one of those weeks again, and I feel like I'm repeating myself for the past 3 times I've been on here, for anyone that's been keeping track. But it's Roper Central again for me this week. Yeah. It's been very heavy on the Ropers. Obviously people are winding down for the holidays now as well, so again a lot of last minute quick things coming in, so it's been pretty busy on our end over on the delivery side, but it's been pretty fun actually. I do always enjoy jumping on the rope because of loads of different people, just making sure that, you know, making sure we know exactly which ones we're doing for each one, because I can get lost with them sometimes. I do so many at a time. It's easy to
do. Yeah, but I feel partly responsible for that.
There's more than partly.
How are you doing, Laura?
Yeah, not too bad. I've been in school wrap-up, so it's school holidays coming up. So I've been in Saarland this week. That's
all right,
been my week.
Nice.
Lots of Saar advice, everyone getting them out the door before they go on their break.
Yeah, I can imagine. I'm still trying to get my head around things as I'm back from Berlin now. I ended up extending my holiday for the final. Maybe some regrets there, but no, I'm really joking. But yeah, I've been trying to get back on top of things. I've seen in the news, well, I'm sure everyone's heard of the King's Speech by now. We can finally confirm that the DPDI, the data... Digital Information Data Protection Bill. My head's gone.
Yeah, that's right.
It is finally dead and buried. But it is replaced by the Digital Information and Smart Data Bill, I believe. Should get my notes up, really. Which, you know, will replace it as well as the... That word. Cyber...
The Security and Reliance Bill.
Cyber Security and Reliance Bill. Resilience Bill, even.
Resilience.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what is taken from the previous DPDI bill, Data Protection and Digital Information, isn't it? And, you know, what will take its place, really. I'm not sure how I'm feeling about it. I'm not sure if you've seen, you know, what it's going to entail. There's a few things that we do know so far, such as the potential return of digital ID.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a few questions around that. Have you seen anything about it, Laura?
I've not. I've been in my SAR land, so I've not read anything on it yet.
Yeah, it's one of those things, isn't it, Jocelyn? I know sort of me and you sort of touched on it very, very, very lightly whilst we've been in the office together, but there's an element of, I suppose, concern there, and definitely some risks, which is, you know, very, very, very relevant to what we're going to be talking about today in terms of risk. But there's risks there that are definitely present. I know there were issues before regarding the storage of that data, you know, with an ID, with something as sensitive as your passport or something like that. It essentially is, you know, you really need to make sure that a very detailed and granular approach is taken for something like that. It's a difficult thing to approach, and, you know, I hope as per this session that they do a DPIA on it. It would be nice to see.
Definitely. For those of you who aren't aware of, you know, the purpose behind it, as far as I can tell, it's to help with things like mortgages and you know, applying for mortgages, online, things like that. So I suppose in some ways, you know, it would be useful. You know, it's essentially just a digital passport, like you said, Kane, but you know, public services don't have the best track record recently when it comes to people's personal data. So we will see. We will see how that is mitigated in the DPIA after we put in an FOI.
Yeah, definitely watch the space, I imagine. I'm sure stuff will be coming up about it frequently.
Yeah. There's also no fully pledged AI Act, but there are intentions to cover high risk AI technologies and so on within legislation, but low risk, it doesn't really specify, so we'll have to keep an eye on that as well. But yeah, it's all change. Did you mention last week or not about the Department for Science, Innovation and Technology intending to expand as well?
A little bit, but I reckon we can touch on it slightly, just in case there's a few people that didn't quite get there last week.
Yeah. Well, that is it essentially.
Yeah, is it? Yeah.
Yeah. So they're planning to expand there, and yeah, I suppose that's all I can say on that one. But it's worth highlighting anyway. Have you seen anything else in the news?
I know when I was looking at some issues, not really issues as such, but looking within it in itself. And I know, was it Lord Holmes that was talking about? It was about the AI Act itself. He wants to bring that sort of further along with Parliament, doesn't it? I mean, I believe the main sort of focus on the news at the moment these past couple of weeks have all been around AI. I know it's a big thing, and it's something that's developing so frequently at the moment that, you know, I think there's a real scramble to stay on top of things as well, which, you know, on all sides. I know there's a push with the EU, the EU organisations, for them to basically be forefront in this AI and be the ones to sort of be the MSAs for that. I know there was talks about that within the EU, wasn't there, Jasmine?
So the data protection authorities across the EU will also be responsible for, under the EU AI Act, which makes sense, really. But
unless you're going to sort of pop up a new body out of nowhere, but the people that are already working within a similar space should really be the people most responsible for it, right?
Yeah, and I think that's probably why, you know, the Department for Science, Innovation and Technology is expanding to follow suit, really, and we'll probably see that with the ICO. So Obviously, EU legislation doesn't directly apply to the UK, but it is very influential. So
yeah,
we'll
it's telling, isn't it? Yeah,
presses.
It's one of those things. It's almost like a preemptive thing. We get to take a little bit of a look beneath the curtain before we start to look at things on our end, which is, you know, interesting. Yeah. It helps us prepare, to say the least.
Yeah. Now, before we get started on the main part of the session, which is why everyone is here primarily, I do want to let everyone know, for those that might have missed this in the previous weeks, that we are actually IAPP approved, which means that you can gain credits for listening to the podcast. So one credit per podcast, so it's, you know, make a note of that. I think that's why we're seeing over 100 attendees, you know, consistently, which is great to see. And also, you know, while this can be used as IAPP credits, it's worth noting that we do have a session on DPIA training coming up in September. So if you want to know more about that, then let me know and I can put a link to what it covers within the chat. But yes, DPIAs. So what is your experience with DPIAs? Do you like them? Do you hate them? How do you take them on?
Well, I think the way it's sort of been at DPP for me is that I initially started, I'm not going to say hate because I don't hate any element of data protection, but initially when I first started at DPP, for some reason there was just an abundance of them. I just kept getting given them and it was almost gritting your teeth and getting free. But now it's something I love. I absolutely love DPI. It's one of my favorite things to do in regards to data protection. But, you know, I think people probably have a similar sort of feeling towards it in terms of it. So sometimes it can be a little bit love to hate. Or hate to love, both on both sides, just because, you know, as much as you do like doing them, they can be really quite long. Quite long. You have to be particularly granular, and especially looking from an internal perspective as a DPO as well, I can only imagine the pain that could be, you know, making even like the aftermath and all that sort of stuff, and getting it done and organizing them, making sure you've highlighted them within a business is a real task. But no, I'm very passionate about DPIs, which is why I'm glad that we've had the session and I'm on this one, because I'm very much looking forward to talking about it.
Yeah, there's loads to talk about. What about you, Laura?
I love a good DPIA. At the moment, we're getting a lot for schools bringing CCTV in, places like public bathrooms and stuff. So they're always an reading what they put forward for that is always an exciting read.
Yeah.
Things like vapes. Yeah. Need to be monitored is not a lawful ground.
Okay. That was that justification, wasn't it?
I had a similar experience in the fact that when I first started in data protection and I had to do DPIAs, they used to just, you know, blow my mind a little bit. I just struggled to understand them. I didn't enjoy them. And then as my knowledge around data protection improved and you know, I grew into the space a little bit more, I loved just getting stuck into a project and really, you know, understanding the nooks and crannies of it, trying to identify the risks, which can be hard to identify. They can be hard to define, you know, how do you define a risk first of all? So there are levels to that. But yeah, I enjoyed getting stuck into them as time went on. But I won't lie, there are still some elements that just do go over my head, like within the definition, for example. I've not had to touch a DPIA in a little while now, you know, within my role, but I just pass that on to you guys. But I do have to refresh my memory and really understand what some of the phrases and terms actually mean, like systematic and extensive processing, for example. It can be tricky, or defining large scale where there is no definition.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the issue sometimes, is I think the lack of definition. In particular, in looking at risks, I know, and what high risk is, I know some recitals touch upon it and stuff like that. Large scale as well. I mean, the only thing we sort of really have to go off of is what the working party says, so WP29. They sort of give you a guidance on what you're looking at when you're looking at large scale. But in terms of what we get from a UK perspective, that's sort of all we really have to go off of. And I think sometimes pinning things down, and I wonder when what everyone's opinion is on this, really, because I think trying to pin things down as a risk by it being large scale is almost a little bit restrictive. I don't think a processing is high risk just because it's large scale. And I don't think that's a cutoff point. I think, for example, things like monitoring like a public space, but it has to be on a large scale. I'd probably still want to see a DPIA if there's CCTV in general, and most people do, right? It's pretty common practice that most people do something similar, even if it's like a privacy impact assessment or something like that. It's very common that you do see things relating to that. But I think the large scale can be restricted and can sort of cut out the need to do a DPIA in some people's minds, which I would always try argue against where possible.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Yeah. I would agree. It's we was looking at it before, Kane, in terms of criminal conviction data and special category data, where, you know, regardless of
whether or not you drop off an entire podcast.
Yeah, well, Jasmine has just disappeared off the face of the earth there. I think she might have given up on DPIAs.
Or she's got really passionate about doing one and has dropped off to...
Dropped off in the process, yeah. I think she might have been that angry. I think she's just sort of thrown her mice around and accidentally left or something.
I don't think someone liked what I was saying because I got removed from the chat, from the session. Right, okay. Here we go. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Laura, are you still here? I can't see you.
Oh, what?
I think someone's playing with us.
Laura's dropped off as well.
That's weird.
Someone's playing a cruel trick, I believe.
Yeah. Well, it's just what
we
need.
It's quite funny. Yeah. It's not what we expected.
So someone said in the chat, can you describe the difference between a DPIA and a PIA, privacy impact assessment or data protection impact assessment? And I think you are right, Carly, that PIA is just old terminology. I think it might be a term used by...
It's the EU, isn't it, mainly, that use PIA, I believe.
I think it could be also used under the... CCTV, you know, the surveillance commissioner. I could be wrong. I remember seeing that CCTV surveillance. I'll have a look and get back to you on that. Right, where is Laura?
I think what you're saying, Lawrence, is bang on right. I think privacy is a bit wider. I did see a LinkedIn post actually about sort of the differentiating between the two, between privacy and data protection. Because there is a difference, and I know people like to bundle them as one of the same. Especially on support, we used to always see PIAs pretty much only exclusively for CCTV floating about. I think, not anymore. I don't think I've seen one for a good old year, probably more than that. But you are right. I think they do touch upon a more broader scale in terms of when we're looking at privacy. Laura, where is Laura?
She's had a client. She got kicked off and then had a client call. So she said she'll be back.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
God. But yeah, where were we, Jasmine? We were talking about large scale, weren't we?
Yes. I think that's a common issue, you know, that we always get asked about what is large scale and how do you go about defining it? I think the ICO says that, it, you know, compared to the size of a large hospital. But I don't think I think it's too narrow to, you know, to compare, because for me personally, I'll take into account the size of the organization and how many records of personal data they collect in general. And then I'm just reading the chat. And then from there, how many is special category data or criminal offense data or whatever it is, you know, in terms of considering large scale. Also the volume of the data, the how long to keep it for, etc. It's all these things that need to come into play when determining whether it's large scale in comparison to that specific organization.
I agree. It is so context heavy, as Peter says. You know, I was touching upon the working party, and they do say that they consider the number of the data subjects concerned, so either as like a specific number or a population in terms of proportion, the volume of the data, so whether that changes. The duration of it, you know, how long is that going to be helpful? And I can't remember who touched upon it, Owen there, but the geographical scope as well, seeing where that reaches. And it is, I think DPIAs are something that are so context and context heavy, even if it's context within a business, context within a sector. I think it all changes what high risk is and what, in particular, what large scale is, I believe. And that's why I think it can be a little bit grey when you're looking at that one. And I see a lot of people tick it, and sometimes I'll sit back and think, you know, would I call this large scale? I think in terms of the guidance we've got, maybe not. But from a context perspective, I can also see why people come to that conclusion as well.
I think as well, you know, in terms of the initial exercise to determine whether a DPIA is necessary, it worries me in a sense that some people might see that as very black and white, you know. So if something, you know, if they are processing special category data, but it's not on a large scale, and then if they're monitoring a public space, but it's not on a large scale, for example, there might be half of a requirement for multiple different criteria. So they determine, no, a DPIA isn't necessary because there's no full, you know, certain criteria that's been met. But if you consider all of these factors together, then you probably should do one.
So how do you sort of treat that approach then, maybe back on the consultancy days for you, Jasmine? But I know for me, I feel like where they're half meeting some of these boxes, or even like touching upon them slightly, what's your approach to that? Do you always recommend that you do a DPIA for most things? Is where do you sort of sit with that? Because from my perspective, I see a lot of checklists done for every process and activity. And I think from an accountability perspective and like a login perspective, I think it's great. I like it a lot. But is there to a point where it gets a little bit too much? Is there anything that you would consider, or maybe that you would guide people in when you think it might be necessary to do one, in terms of just the checklist and when you probably would just leave it out?
Good question. I think approach it from both sides, it might be worth putting it into process to check whether a DPIA is necessary with any new process and activity, but adding a step rather than doing the checklist straight away, adding a step to discuss with the data protection officer or lead for them to have a more informed, you know, opinion to then go on to the next step. Because then it saves some time, because a lot of organizations are resource tight, and they might not see it as a very time effective process, which I do understand. But at the same time, you do want to cover all bases and make sure that you are considering DPAs where necessary. So it's, you know, I don't think there's one approach that works for every organization. I think you should, you know, there's no harm in checking whether a DPA is necessary as opposed to the opposite way. So that's what I'd say. It's difficult to determine based, you know, on thought alone for anyone in the organization, whether something's high risk or not. So there does need to be that involvement with the DPO to then decide whether it should be taken further.
Yeah. And that sort of touches upon, for anyone that was here last week, I don't know if you remember the conversation me and Joe had around DPIAs and the post that was made onto LinkedIn about a data protection officer essentially saying that they wouldn't do DPIAs for employees, and that doesn't sit within their responsibility. Now, obviously, I think, as was largely agreed by the majority of us, that we, in a sense, disagree. But the DPOs are there to guide and to be that point of guidance, as opposed to that as a, you know, the figure that will do it all, that will do every element of it, because you're not going to know the processing activities that different departments do inside and out.
I was listening to the chat. Not listening, reading.
it's one of those things, and I think with the DPO, it's always got to be the first contact. I think before you even looking at screening, is you're talking to them and you're figuring it out, and you're trying to work as you're getting over these things. Because even if, to me, if it doesn't flag as a high risk in my mind, I think even trying to take the best risk approach you can, even if there's like a smaller down, sort of whittled down scale in terms of the DPIA, like a low risk DPIA maybe.
Yeah.
I think that's a bad word, I suppose, low risk DPIA, because it's sort of, it's a bit contradictory. But similar to like a low risk supplier questionnaire. Because I think there are still opportunities to do them. And I think it's great practice to show that as a business that you're still taking measures to mitigate risk.
Yeah. I think as well, you've got to take into account the what's best practice as well. You know, just because it might not say in legislation you have to do it in this instance, say, for example, the collection of criminal offence data, and it's not on a large scale, there's still risk there and high risk to those individuals involved, just because it's not as many individuals as what would be considered in large under a large scale process and activity. The risk is still there, and the level of that risk. So it does bug me a little bit that, but in our DPA form, from memory, we set out, you know, within the criteria, the screening checklist, if there's processing of vulnerable people's information, or if there's processing of special category data, and then there's a yes or no, there are yes and no columns. And then there's another column with comments. So I don't think on, you know, going further than that, I don't think it's always a yes and no answer. I don't think it's that simple. I think you need to be able to justify in total why it's not, why it's a no. You know, to then move on to the next one, because if there is a slight risk in there, then it does, you know, it gets the brain ticking, and you need to look into that further.
I mean, even determining that it's a no in itself is taking some form of accountability, is being able to document why there isn't a risk, and which would imply that there's something already in place, right? Or that the process in itself is fairly low risk. But even being able to identify that it is a low risk and why is in a sense helpful, because then you have somewhere to log that and you have somewhere to demonstrate that. It's an interesting thing, and I think the screen and like checklist itself is great, just because it does give you that frame. But I also think the guidelines and sort of the checklist itself, in terms of what Article 35 says, can be a little bit restrictive, as you say. I think in terms of talking about large scale, in terms of what's included on there, it's all about what's a high risk. And I know, again, high risk is something that isn't defined fantastically. There's recitals that sort of very much link it to the risk of individuals in regards to material risk and other sort of issues regarding that. I believe, let me see if I can pull it up, is it recital 75? That's right. So physical, material, non-material damage. So for any examples, like if it could be like risk of physical harm, obviously, if there's risk of discrimination, if there's special category data, that says to me that if you're processing data that could relate to nationality, ethnicity, then why would large scale almost gatekeep that in terms of preventing the DPIA being done there in terms of the legislation by it being large scale or not?
I think one thing about the definition, when you go back to Article 35, it says, so where a type of processing, in particular using new technologies and taking into account the nature, scope, context and purposes of the processing, is likely to result in a high risk to the rights and freedoms of natural persons, the controller shall, prior to the processing, carry out an assessment of the impact of the envisaged processing operations, blah, 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 blah. And then it says, so a data protection impact assessment referenced to in paragraph one shall in particular be required in the case of, and then it provides the examples of systematic and extensive evaluation, processing on a large scale of special category or criminal offence data, and systematic monitoring of publicly accessible area, of a publicly accessible area on a large scale. And when I was rereading this, I paid particular attention to the part where it says, so a DPIA shall in particular be required in the case of etc. And it's that in particular which to me reads as this isn't an exhaustive list, and it obviously isn't, because it says the commissioner, you know, can provide other examples
within section four.
But I do that, you know, that's the beauty of law, and I think that's a bit that can easily get overlooked, but it actually, you know, it is very important in the situation. So it's worth highlighting, you know, that there are other situations. And to me, to be honest, you've got to go off common sense to some level and think, you know, is this likely to result in risk? What are the factors? And it's always context dependent in my eyes when it comes to data protection. So, you know, you've got to take it from there, really. And obviously some organisations who are tight for resource might think, you know, I don't have time to do anything apart from what I legally, you know, mandatory have to do. But at the same time, that I don't think that's good enough in this instance, especially when you're looking at risk. And it opens you up as an organisation if you take that approach in some instances.
Yeah, I think to me it's just considering how beneficial a DPIA is to an organization, because I really think it is. I think it is so beneficial when you're looking at the processing so granularly to such a degree that you can pick out every risk. And when you're looking at, say, that risk mitigation table at the bottom and you've highlighted these, I think a concern I've always had is, do people just leave it there? Do people sort of wash their hands of it after that? You know, they've identified these risks. And then do they say, you know, job done, next one, let's go into the next one now? Or, you know, what is, I hope there's a stringent process in looking at that, because there's occasion where I've seen things where people will, even when required, will say, you know, I'm not going to do a DPIA here, even where there is a requirement to do one, we've highlighted one. And it's not just, I feel like sometimes there's a confusion that it's a matter of best practice, and it isn't. You know, where especially where the checklist is met, there is a requirement to do one. But I think even regardless, once you've done that assessment, the purpose of it was not for it to be the be all and end all. You know, I've met Article 35 and I've done this DPIA. Okay, fine. I think the important thing is the aftermath of the DPIA more than anything. Mm. Highlighting the risks, fantastic, you know, amazing. But the importance is what you're doing afterwards with it. You know, what needs to go into this? You know, if there's particular issues with transfers or maybe retention issues or transparency issues, you know, what are you going to do with the privacy notice? You know, you need to change that to reflect it, you know, and it's not the matter of we can look into that, we can see if it's plausible. It's you either accept the risk, which, you know, we never recommend, or you've got to really look into fixing that. I think it's the largest part of DPIAs. It's not just doing it. It's the aftermath. And I understand it's a lot of heavy lifting, but it's the purpose of the assessment, really, isn't it?
Yeah. You talk about heavy lifting there, and I think that can be one of my concerns sometimes when it comes to DPIAs, because you mentioned earlier that you spoke last week about, you know, the role of the DPO within a DPIA. I don't know how extensively you covered that, so if we can bring it up again, then let's do it. But in terms of, you know, bringing people across the organization, you know, within the relevant department that are, you know, introducing this new process and activity, it sometimes there's issues with getting them bought into the idea of a DPIA. I mean, I'm sure so many people listening into this have had, you know, they found out about a new process and activity or a new project way too late when a DPIA should have been done already. And, you know, I know for a fact that will have happened to probably 50% of people listening. So, it can be difficult to, you know, get them to buy into that initial, okay, we first need to go to the DPO to start this DPIA before we progress this any further. But then also a DPIA needs to be in depth enough to be able to identify the risks. You know, you really need to get involved. I remember someone that that used to work for us, and she helped at the training, my training. I used to shadow her on calls, and we used to do DPAs with customers at times, and it would be, I don't know, 3 hours, and we'd literally get a third through. She was so attention to detail, like ridiculously. But the people on the other side, those that weren't, you know, in day-to-day data protection, that wasn't part of their role. They didn't enjoy it. They switched off. And it's trying to find that right balance between, you know, getting people to engage with this process as much as possible, and documenting as much information as possible while keeping them engaged. It can be a really tricky balance to find.
Oh, 100%. And it's, I suppose you gotta have a culture for it, haven't you? And I imagine it starts just right where it needs to begin with training. I think DPIA is such a difficult thing. Again, last week we touched upon how far you can stretch a DPO possibly. You know, they're not, when you're not made of rubber, you're not going to go forever. There's only so much you guys can do. And it's making sure that the employees are, and your process owners are reliable people to fall back on. And it's, again, with people that don't do them often, and then we're telling them that they need to do it, there's an element of, you know, do I have to? Don't really want to. And a DPIA is something that's difficult to understand. Not with someone that's not really into data protection, even when you first get in data protection, there's an element of high level, because it's over encompassing. It touches on everything. It's a really wide approach and sort of data protection as a whole. So I remember when I first started, I'd look at them and I, it was awful to look at. I was very, very confused at the very start of my career in data protection. And it's one of those things that, as a DPO, how far can we go to help these people in helping them complete it? Because it's not an easy task, because even as much training as they can get, there's still an element of struggling, right? Just because of how detailed it needs to be. And sometimes just not being able to have all the answers, which is perfectly normal. But that, you know, that is what the DPO is there for, as that backup. He's the person that will sit behind you when you need him, you know, your guardian angel of sorts. You know, they are your guardian angel. When they need you, you know, they're there. And that's all you can do. I know you guys in particular, I'm sure, have so much other things on your mind than DPIAs often. And I know you don't want to be completing every single one. So I think training is a huge part of it. I think it really is such a massive part of it.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point, definitely. Because like you say, they are so broad in what they cover. And that's not an expectation to have everybody within the organization to understand all elements of data protection. While that would be nice, it's not
very
realistic.
It would be lovely, wouldn't it?
But I think it is also crucial to have both parties involved in the process, you know, the DPO and the department, let's say. I think it would probably be most effective to have both parties go through the DPIA together at the same time, just to hold the hand and you know, to let them know what level of information they need to be documenting, so then, you know, you can go away and say okay, or go away and review it and identify the risks, and if you need to go back with further questions, then fine. But in that initial instance, because the amount of times that I've seen, I'm not sure about you, Kane, but if somebody within the organization has completed a DPIA, it is very much treated like a tick box exercise, and you have, you know, half written responses, you don't have enough information, if you know, if you're lucky sometimes, and then you've got to go back and go through that process anyway. So it is, and then hopefully, you know, as time goes on, then they will get the hang of it, they know what's expected of them aside, you know, alongside that training.
I do agree, but again, I wonder how difficult it is. Obviously, it's hard for me to know. I've never personally worked internally within a business as a data protection officer, but how easy is that to do, to have to sit with every person? You know, with how many DPIAs are probably going on at once, as well as other things, how easy is that to be, to sit with each person and go through them? You know, when do you find the time? Because you're hoping it's something that you can hash out before you want to start a process, but you know, people are eager, they want to get stuff through, and that's sometimes how things can slip through the cracks. I'm wondering if anyone from the chat maybe wants to sort of explain a bit of an approach that they usually take in terms of employees and their DPIAs. You know, how do you best monitor that? Is there any specific sort of process you guys have, or in terms of training or anything like that? Is there a specific way that you guys think works best?
I suppose the I forgot what my train of thought then. Oh yeah, I suppose the important factor is in the DPIA form more than anything, you know, and how easy that is to understand for the average person, and you know, for teasing out information. But personally, I find that it's never a one size fits all approach when it comes to a DPIA template. You can maneuver it and, you know, tease questions out of people by having that interaction, but a standalone form, it can be so tricky to cover all bases when, you know, if you've got a project that's going on that's relating to something relating to vulnerable individuals, and an event that's being or a project that's being run, a scheme, and then you've got a new system that's coming in, they're completely different things. You know, you're looking at more technical aspects and where the risks are there, compared to human elements of collecting people's data and how that might be shared and so on in that sense. It's two rubbish examples, but the form ideally would tease out the relevant information, would cover every single thing that someone needs to consider within that remit. And you know, it doesn't necessarily happen. It might be worth having two or three forms for different types of processing.
Yeah. And I can see that in the chat as well. I can see that that Shirley's mentioning the about the open sessions as well. Great idea. I think having sessions and one-to-one guidance, fantastic. Carly mentions that they have like they mainly prioritize the higher risk DPIAs, which, you know, as you should, and then have the lighter touch assessments for the lower ones, which is great, as we touch upon, is fantastic for accountability. And I also really, really like the idea of a specific point of contact. You know, they're largely going to be your process owners, right? Who know their stuff better than most and can be that fallback. And it sort of works in a chain almost. So it's
your
point of contact as your first instance. And then, you know, if you're really struggling and you're scratching your head, you've got the DPO there to save the day, as they always do.
Yeah, that's good in terms of having, you know, data champions as well, or it relates to that same approach, you know, with ropers. Mm-hmm. So involving various people within the organization. Usually people are just dumped with this role, you know, they don't always offer for it, but then they do get into it, you know, when they start to understand it a little bit more. It can be quite daunting at the beginning, but then you've got data protection representatives, you know, within your organization that that can help you. And you know, improve the culture on a deeper level.
Yeah, and I think some people have genuinely some really fantastic ideas, and I imagine it's not an easy task. And it's good that there are options and that you can rely on your process owners in the way that you do, because I think culture is more important than ever in terms of stuff with data protection. I think having an organization that is really active in getting involved in it and being eager to do it is key, just because it will make your guys' life so much easier. You know, you're not there to do it all. You're not there. That's just how it is. You're there to be the person that can support and guide and be the overall person that oversees it. But having employees and organizations that know what they need to do, maybe not to the same level of intricacy that you will. But if they have enough to give it a good enough go to then be passed back to you and leave you with a little bit smaller of a job, I think that's the importance. But
yeah,
I think I've seen just touching upon the form, Andy there touching upon the form and making it a little bit easier to understand. I mean, from your experience, Jazz, in terms of our form and forms you've seen, like the ICO form and stuff like that, how easy do you think it is to understand?
That's a good question, actually, because for me, the ICO form, I don't like it at all. I don't think it teases out enough information. Is it three sections or something like that? With just, you know, a massive text box. It doesn't set any standard or expectation for what should be within a DPIA form. So how, you know, would anybody really know without further help, I suppose? Mm-hmm. And that's what the ICO should be there for, in my opinion. Not the help side, the form side of that conversation. In terms of our form, so one thing I always do when it comes to data protection, probably just through having to deal with people within my role as an account manager with all levels of understanding, is think about how I felt when I first got into data protection and what I understood and how easy things were to pick up or not so easy. And say, you know, when you're following the wording of the legislation, so considering the nature, scope, context, that can go over your head. You know, it can just be words until you actually start to delve into it and understand. And sometimes a bit of hand-holding is necessary. But it is also, you know, our form, for example, is in line with the requirements under the GDPR. So it considers these things. And then at the end, there is a risk register that we have. So I think, you know, it does follow a sensible trajectory when you go through it and when you start to familiarize yourself with the form. But it can be tricky regardless. I think one of the tricky things is determining how risky something is and how do you define high risk. You know, it is subjective. There is what do you consider? You know, there's different factors, obviously, but what do you consider, Kane?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, as you know, it's very, as I say, context specific in terms of your sector, the personal data typically being processed. It's one of those things when I'm looking at risk is I tend to look at it from a breach perspective usually. Just, you know, worst case scenario, this data is, you know, out and about, it's gone and you need to recover it. You know, how much of a risk does that have to the individuals?
Mm.
You know, what does that leave them with if there's anything, again and again, it's so hard, but you're looking at things as well as the data subject. But as an organization? You know, if there's no retention period, what does that mean for you as an organization? You know, if that data can't be deleted by your supplier, what does that imply for you guys? You know, the supply chain, it may be, say, a processor or a sub-processor's failing, but ultimately that ties to you. And you've got to look at it from the perspective of you guys as an organization and your compliance, as well as looking at the risks of the data subject from processing that data and the implications it would mean if that got out and it wasn't handled appropriately.
Yeah. I use this this example time and time again. So sorry if anyone's bored of it. I always change the context a little bit. But there was a situation where somebody put in a right to issued their right to erasure for their employee start date, which was publicized on an internal HR system. So they wanted that removing from their profile on this HR system. And the organization, they inquired with the software provider whether they can remove this. And the software provider basically said, no, if you do, you've got to have a bespoke system, and that is £30,000 for this small piece of information to be able to enforce somebody's rights. £30,000, which just obviously it's not feasible for most organizations. There's the financial element from an organization side that, you know, you can consider as a risk. There is also the reputational element. If you don't comply, you could get fined by the ICO if you don't comply. So there's, from an organizational perspective, there's these things to consider. There's probably way more, but this is off the top of my head. And then I think from an individual side, you've got to remember that, and as I'm sure most of you do, that DPIAs and data protection in general, it affects people's lives. It's a real issue. If it's data protection isn't enforced appropriately. So what risks are there? There's physical risk of physical harm, risk of mental and emotional harm, like distress maybe, or I don't know, a knock-on effect from a breach between multiple parties.
It's why I wonder that special category data on its own, or criminal conviction data on its own, doesn't really flag one. Which I get, it can be, again, context specific. I don't think it will always require the need for one, and I think sometimes that can be a bit much. But with the context and stuff tied in, is this stuff is considered sensitive for a reason, just because of the potential effect to an individual if that come out. And I think that's what a DPI is there for. It's there to prevent those risks, and a big part of risk is the sensitivity of the data involved. And I think regardless of the scale, I think at the end of the day, you've got to remember data protection compliance isn't just business related. It's there to protect an individual. As much as it is important for a business, it is just as important to an individual to have their data processed properly.
Yeah, definitely. Like you say, thinking of it in the context of breaches is very helpful. And there are different types of breaches. There's personal data breaches, and there's non-compliance as well. So you can think about it from both perspectives. What helps me, and obviously I don't know if this will help many people, especially if you're not our customer, but in our breach form, we have an assessment as to whether it should be reported and whether individuals should be notified. And within that, we consider the level of harm posed, and that includes things like physical harm, mental and emotional harm, and financial harm, etc. And it's really useful to cross-reference really and see, what are the resources you have that can help you in completing a DPIA form, and then identifying those risks that need to be mitigated.
Absolutely. I think one thing that interests me about Article 35 specifically is where they talk about consultation to the data subject themselves. Now, I'm curious as to if this ever really happens. When we're looking at the consultation process itself, obviously it's within the DPIAs, we want to see who's been discussed before this happened. And, typically it's going to be internal people. You're talking to your IT guys, your risk guys, of course. Us guys as well. But is there any instance where you're looking at reaching out to the data subject and getting their opinion? Do you see that worthwhile as a business? Do you think if you can highlight a lawful basis that's as applicable, do you think it's necessary to reach out and get a data subject sort of point of view?
Someone has, Carly. She says, We've consulted data subjects for very sensitive data, in our case students, so that's good to see.
Yeah.
I think we normally get the wrath of panic when it comes to DPIAs, of some of, you know, of the relevant people being informed too late, or if it's a retrospective DPIA. I have heard in the past as well, you know, somebody saying that, oh no, we're not going to do a DPIA because we're already processing it. You know, this is a retrospective exercise that we're looking at our processing activities, and we're already doing this, so a DPIA is not needed. That does not mean that the risks are not there, you know,
because
you've been doing it for so long, it only takes one split second for something to go wrong, really.
Mm. Yeah, and it's nice to hear that some of you guys are reaching out to the data subjects as well. I think students in particular is really interesting, because obviously that level of, I suppose, data protection awareness needs to be relatively high. And I wonder what steps are sort of taken there in terms of keeping them informed, because I believe it's something we touched upon quite a few weeks ago now, about like younger generation, was specifically Gen Z, and about being aware of data protection and their rights in regard to that. And I wonder, because it's never something I was aware of in school or anything like that. And I wonder if it's something that should be made more of a push of in making people aware of this, and what sort of measures could be in place to keep children sort of more aware, or younger adults aware of data protection as a whole.
Yeah, I think the Children's Code of Practice is useful there as well. I remember going through, I remember writing a DPIA for an organisation that were developing have developed a platform in which students can apply to university courses and college courses and so on. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of focus on how to make it, you know, somebody mentioned earlier in the chat, how to make sure it's data protection by design and default. And it's, you know, it's a really good exercise for that. It's also very important, and it doesn't mean that because you've not already done it that you shouldn't change it and improve it. And data protection, you know, it's always improving. And I think mm-hmm. as well, when you think about the ICO, and if you know, they were to be notified about something, then what would their reaction be? Okay, well, what are you doing about it? What have you done about it? And if you are evidencing the fact that you're considering these issues, then that will help so much, especially on the case of best practice as well.
Sure.
Because something might not be mandatory to do a DPIA on, but if, you know, if it does kind of, if it would be, if it makes sense to do it, then
mm-hmm.
then do it.
agreed. It is one of those things, you know, it's a common sense approach. You know, does it make sense for us to actually look at this? But I think just because I'm wary of the time, Jasmine, I think it might be important to touch upon like reviewing DPIAs in terms of, well, once it's been done, the aftermath's been done, you know, what would you expect? You know, I know what the law says. We know that the law says that you have to look at it where there's any changes that may affect anything to do with the processing or the, you know, the potential impact that may have. But what would you recommend? You know, what are you looking at? I know it was touched upon in the chat a little bit higher up about reviewing periods. But when you are reviewing it, you know, first of all, how often, and what type of things do you want to see in terms of, you know, have things been actioned? Does stuff need to still be actioned?
Yeah, I think in terms of reviewing it, you know, well, first of all, make sure that you check whether there's been any changes to the project or process and activity. That's your first port of call, and whether any amends need to be made to the DPIA form, or whether a new DPIA form is needed if it's so far from the original processing. So that'd be my first port of call. Then from there, it's mainly just looking at the risks, really, and seeing if they're still ongoing, if they've been mitigated or eliminated or increased. You know, is there more of a risk because of other changes across the business? There's a lot to consider there. So that is where I'd focus.
Yeah, and I think it is looking at, you know, have the risk been mitigated? You know, and it's not the case of it's always going to happen. You know, no, nothing can 100% be mitigated ever. You know, it's one of those things. But it's looking at it and thinking, you know, that we've highlighted issues with retention here, say, or our lawful basis. Have we actually changed anything? You know, have we actually looked at anything that we were meant to in this period of time? You know, is that risk still present? And you want to, yeah, I think what you said about sort of the scope is really interesting, and looking at if the process in itself has sort of surpassed that in terms of the original purpose of it. Because I imagine that probably happens quite often, because businesses develop so fast, and once things trickle in, they trickle in fast and really quite quickly, in terms of, you know, you're probably struggling to keep up a little bit with how quick things are moving. And I wonder how many times you have to look at a DPI and think, like, let's start anew, because this has just changed so differently from, you know, that 6 month period or that 12 month period since we last looked at it.
Yeah, especially when it's, say, a new piece of technology, and it's, you know, there's a load of excitement around this new shiny toy. You know, you've got to be a bit harsh at times, and like just slow everyone down, and, you know, take a step back and actually consider it. And whether then, you know what, another thing to consider is when you get to the end of a DPA, do you consider that it's too high risk to do it or not? Because that is something that I've not seen a lot of. You know, obviously there's the step of mitigating risks, but is, you know, does it get to a stage where you think, no, this is just too risky, let's abandon this project?
I mean, yeah, you're right. It's, I mean, I suppose we've been highly touching upon identification and mitigation, but on the identification side, what if it is a little bit too much of a risk to do? And it, as I say, that's why it's not one of those things that's one and done. The assessment is not the key, as much as it is the start of the race. And if there's not enough that you can do, even if after, you know, mitigating as much as you possibly can, and there's still quite a significant risk there, would you want to accept that as a business? Probably not. I wouldn't think so. But I wonder if it's the case of sometimes organizations may complete one and then think, now that one has been completed, that risk has suddenly disappeared, you know, it's up and gone. And I'd like to hope that approach isn't taken, but I wonder if there is a lack of, you know, as I said before, action on these and actually looking at it from, you know, has this risk actually gone anywhere? Like, as I'm completing this, do I see a risk still? Well, the answer is going to be yes, because completing the assessment in itself is not stopping that risk. It's identifying it in the first instance, is what comes afterwards. I know you touched upon risk registers, which I think are really important, actually, and I think probably touched upon them a little bit in the Roper session, didn't you, a couple of weeks ago?
Actually, I don't know if we did, but that will be
all right. Okay. Yeah, sure. Well, look forward to that, guys.
In terms of DPAs, you know, determining that the risk is too high to continue, I've seen it with an organization, and I don't know if they even got to the point of the DPIA, because my point of contact, she handles that side of things herself. She didn't tie us into that, but she needed advice on the wider issue. So it was, they're a housing association, and also they provide support to really, really vulnerable individuals, like disabled people, people who struggle with their mental health, etc. And they have a lot of contracts with the NHS and local authorities and other third parties, and data sharing is just an absolute minefield. Like, honestly, I don't know how she's still in that job having to deal with it all, because it is so complicated, and every third party wants, you know, their own data sharing agreement in place. It's just all, it's a mess. And it's very difficult to work with the third parties, especially local authorities, if anybody's had any dealings with that. And it was decided that I think it was decided between the local authority and maybe an NHS provider, and then they were sucked into it, that there would be this central platform where they can all deposit information in, but there were issues around, you know, access controls within this. So obviously, you know, your first thought would be making sure that only that each organization can only access certain types of information, which would be specified, and then individuals within those organizations, you know, there's access controls, role-based access controls there as well. But for some reason this wasn't feasible. I think it was probably because of the choice of platform they were going for, or the cost options or something like that. And, you know, she was panicking, saying this isn't, you know, data protection compliant, like, at all. Like, there's no way it could be in this instance. And the other organizations, that they were still wanting to go ahead, you know, they weren't listening to her as the data protection officer.
It makes sense.
It wasn't their main priority. They were thinking, this is going to save loads of time, loads of money. It's going to be way easier to manage. And it's like, what do you do in that instance? You know, you're battling as an individual within, you know, a small housing association / charity. You're battling against a local authority, the NHS, GPs, all these other third parties, charities, etc. What do you do from there? And, you know, it's just an example of how difficult it can be. And you know, 100%.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I just feel sorry
for
people and in that situation.
I have nothing but sympathy.
Shirley said, yes, the old, we've bought this thing, help me make it compliant scenario, being there.
I bet there's a lot of that, I bet you see that.
There is, unfortunately.
It's too late then, right? Yeah, that's the issue. You know, you gotta look at it from the forefront where you can, and it must be difficult trying to keep track of all these people that want, you know, a nice new shiny thing. And you know, I can only empathize because that side does sound awful.
It's always after, you know, the pilot schemes and all these conversations, and everyone's always excited that then you even get notified in some instances as well. So
yeah,
in terms of battling that, it's partly good luck, also training, and you know, just constant just visibility, you know, and constantly being there in the corner, just lurking. No, I'm joking, but you know, just yeah that presence. It doesn't have to be lurking in the shadows, but just constantly reminding people of that you're there and the importance of it, because they soon find out as well that when, you know, you step in and you say, no, this needs taking back a step, or we can't do it, etc., that it causes twice as more work than it did in the first place. So either they learn the hard way, or they bring you in soon enough. So
yeah absolutely.
Anyway, I am rambling on, so it is past the hour mark, but thank you everyone for joining. I will try and send out that DPIA training information sheet afterwards to everyone that's interested, and yeah, we'll be back next week for GDPR radio, but in the meantime, thanks for joining. Thank you, Kane, for joining me.
No problem.
It will be very different without you. And we hope you have a good weekend and week until we meet again.
Thanks guys, see you later.
See you later.